Big box chain Walmart is beginning to think small. The world's largest retailer plans to build express markets across the country. The reduced retail design allows the company access to small town streets, but it also poses a new threat to local merchants. Jacqueline Froelich of member station KUAF in Fayetteville, Arkansas, has more.
Possibly the world's tiniest Walmart is here on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville. The garage-sized prototype carries many of the things college kids crave: frozen pizza, soda, and candy. Today, Ian Plummer's buying mac and cheese.
It's definitely cheaper than a lot of the other places on campus, so it's nice to save a little bit as well.
Arkansas-based Walmart is building smaller supermarkets and express markets in order to better fit on Main Street and to compete with burgeoning dollar store chains. Some of these new, smaller Walmarts will even have pharmacies, including this one in Prairie Grove. Mirelle Nelson operates the Antique Emporium, just a few doors down from her town pharmacist.
And so if the new pharmacy comes in, well, people will tend to go there because they're going to get their eggs and their bacon and their lettuce and their drugs.
And that's exactly what Walmart is hoping shoppers will do. Reading from a prepared statement, Walmart spokesman David Tovar describes likely inventory.
Specifically, the new format will feature an assortment of fresh food, dry grocery, consumables, health and beauty aids, over-the-counter medicines, and limited general merchandise.
Mel Collier owns a small pharmacy in Prairie Grove. He says their Walmart survival plan is to do more for their customers.
We offer the personal service. We have free delivery. We do the things that they're not going to do. We're going to have the personal patient interaction. And it's just not something Walmart's known for.
But independent store owners have reason to worry. Nelson Lichtenstein is author of The Retail Revolution, How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business.
If the Walmart initiative is successful, of course, it will have a competitive effect on small urban retailers of, you know, less than 20,000 square feet, which there are lots and lots of stores.
And of course, Lichtenstein says, the dollar store chains.
Those are the ones that are really cheap. They're dirty, they're understaffed, they're in strip malls, but they're now expanding. This is a function of the terrible economic conditions for many American consumers, and Walmart wants to meet that challenge.
That's because research shows nearly half of Walmart's customers now browse dollar stores. For NPR News, I'm Jacqueline Froelich in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
This is NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A busy week in Congress. Lawmakers passed a spending plan that keeps the government open the rest of this fiscal year. Then the House of Representatives approved a financial blueprint for the coming fiscal year. House Republicans passed the new budget yesterday without a single Democrat voting for it. Its prospects, of course, in the Democratic-controlled Senate are dim, but it will likely provide lots of fodder for next year's campaigns, as NPR's David Wellner reports.
House Republicans are not all that crazy about the budget deal approved on Thursday. It was, after all, a compromise with Democrats to prevent a government shutdown. 59 Republicans, about a quarter of the GOP caucus, voted against it, and Speaker John Boehner had to rely on the votes of Democrats to get it passed. Yesterday, Boehner portrayed that budget as an opening for Republicans to do what they really want to do.
It was an imperfect bill, but it was a positive step that has cleared the decks and allowed us to focus on cutting trillions of dollars, not just billions.
And that's exactly what the Republican budget for next year does. It cuts nearly $6 trillion in spending over the next 10 years. It chops 10 percentage points off the top tax rates. The new health care law gets axed in the budget, and perhaps most significantly, the document proposes transforming Medicare into a system in which elderly people would buy private health insurance with a government-issued voucher. Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan says the plan, which would take effect 10 years from now, is all about protecting Medicare.
We save Medicare, prevent its bankruptcy, and what does the other side do? They sit by and watch the program go bankrupt.
Hands off our Medicare!
Hands off our Medicare! Hands off our Medicare!
Yesterday outside the Capitol, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi led a small rally denouncing the GOP budget's plan for Medicare. Later, she spoke on the House floor.
I want to say to my Republican colleagues, do you realize that your leadership is asking you to cast a vote today to abolish Medicare as we know it? Because that is the vote that we have.
But Majority Leader Eric Cantor casts the budget's overhaul of Medicare as a profile in courage.
While it may be seen by some as politically risky, we Republicans are willing to lead because, to be frank, complacency is not an option.
Arizona Republican Jeff Flake plans to push the Medicare voucher plan as he campaigns for a Senate seat, and he expects that will make him the target of political attacks.
I expect Democrats to try to use scare tactics, as they have before. I fully expect that. I just don't expect them to be successful.
Ohio Republican Steve LaTourette did have some misgivings, but he still voted for the GOP budget.
I'm not crazy about the way, you know, how Congressman Ryan's vision of what Medicare should look like in the out years, but it doesn't mean it's going to look like that.
Democrats think Republicans have grossly misjudged public sentiment.
There's overwhelming public opposition to ending Medicare.
New Jersey Democrat Rob Andrews.
It cuts across party lines, class lines, geographical lines, and I think as long as we Democrats come up with a credible alternative to help restrain the deficit, we win this argument.
But the argument is not only about next year's budget. Of even greater consequence is a fast-approaching deadline for raising the debt ceiling. Speaker Boehner said yesterday that Republicans won't do that without getting something big in return.
There will be no debt limit increase unless it's accompanied by serious spending cuts and real budget reforms.
But even under the GOP budget, the debt ceiling would have to be raised, since it too runs huge deficits for many years to come. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
This week, as President Obama presented his budget plan and criticized Congressman Ryan's plan, he invoked the name of David Stockman, the first budget director under former President Ronald Reagan. Mr. Stockman also found faults in the Republican proposal. Here's how the president put it.
Ronald Reagan's own budget director said there's nothing serious or courageous about this plan. There's nothing serious about a plan that claims to reduce the deficit by spending $1 trillion on tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And I don't think there's anything courageous about asking for sacrifice from those who can least afford it and don't have any clout on Capitol Hill.
David Stockman joins us from his offices in Greenwich, Connecticut. Mr. Stockman, thanks for coming back on our show.
Glad to be on with you.
How do you feel about being quoted by President Obama?
Well, it's a little surprising. You know, this is getting to be an issue where a lot more clarity is needed. I think the president made some headway, but I would be critical of one thing he said as well, and that is that we're going to let the tax cuts expire for the top 2%, but the rest of the country is going to get an extension of the Bush tax cuts, apparently, for the indefinite future. Well, I disagree with that. We can't afford that. In other words, the problem with the Ryan plan is it tries to balance the budget on the back of the poor, and you can't do that. The president's talking about reducing the deficit entirely on the top 2% of the population, and that won't work either. And neither side is being honest with the middle class, and that is that we're going to have tax increases to pay for this huge amount of government we seem to want. And that middle-class entitlements like Medicare and Social Security are going to have to be trimmed right now if we're really going to address this problem.
Seems like both parties say we have to get this entitlement monster by the neck, the throat, the head, whatever, and wrestle it to the ground. Various proposals as to how to do that. The president suggested that people that wanted to change the basic nature of a program like Medicare are upsetting the basic social compact in America. How do you feel?
I disagree with him on that. What we have to do is look at means testing, and that is there are 40 million people receiving these programs who probably can't afford to pay any more or to have benefits reduced because it's their main source of support, in retirement. But there are 10 or 15 million people at the upper end of the income spectrum who are retired, who do have substantial private assets, who do have substantial pension and other sources of income. And given the fiscal circumstances we face, they're going to have to share in the sacrifice. They're going to have their benefits cut back.
A lot of people have noted that the very nature of the conversation in Washington, D.C. seems to have changed, where it's no longer about whether or not to rein in spending, but how much. It doesn't sound as if you were impressed by the debate on either side.
Well, look, the rhetoric, I guess, has changed to some degree, although people have been denouncing the deficit for the last 30 years, and we have $14 trillion of debt today. When in 1980, when I joined the Reagan administration, we had $1 trillion of debt as a country. So this $39 billion cut to the fiscal 211 current fiscal year was a total phony. It was an outright swindle. My calculation is that it would save less than $1 billion in actual cash outlays in lower borrowing requirements between now and the end of the fiscal year. And, you know, if you think about it, if a private business in this country said the number is $39 billion and actually it was $1 billion, they would have the SEC, the Justice Department, and every prosecutor in the country on their case for misrepresentation and fraud, right? Any honest appraisal would say, if this is what they're going to do, we've got some pretty serious problems ahead.
David Stockman, former Michigan Republican congressman and budget director under President Ronald Reagan, speaking with us from Greenwich, Connecticut. Thanks very much, Mr. Stockman.
Okay, thank you.
U.S. factories produced more goods for a ninth consecutive month, but in many of the country's rural one-industry towns, financial hardship continues. In northern Maine, local officials are racing against the clock to reopen two paper mills before they're shut down for good, disassembled and sold for scrap. As Jay Field of Maine Public Radio reports, hundreds of jobs and the already fragile economies of two communities are at risk.
The mills sit on the bank of the Penobscot River. Unoccupied masses of concrete, steel trusses, conveyor belts, and buildings, many football fields long. Flatbed 18-wheelers filled with logs drive past without stopping.
Failure is not an option, and giving up is certainly not an option.
Mark Scally stands outside the East Millinocket Municipal Building, staring at the mill across the street. He's head of the town's board of selectmen, and a little over a week ago, Scally was still hopeful local officials here sell this mill and the one in nearby Millinocket to Meriturn Partners, a San Francisco turnaround company, for $1 in cash and millions in property tax breaks. But the deal collapsed.
There were 14 buyers for this mill at one point, or at least 14 interested parties. But now the Meriturn has cleared the way by making us do our concessions. Perhaps we're more attractive to some of these people. Now they've realized how low we'll sink in order to accommodate the jobs they create.
Unless a new buyer steps forward, the mills will close for good on April 29th. More than 600 jobs will disappear in an area where the unemployment rate is already above 15%. The state's political leaders are working with local officials and the current owner to prevent that from happening. But if they fail, a way of life that treated so many so well for so long here will cease.
You can see the stacks a little bit of the mill from here still.
Yeah, I walked back and forth to work all my life. Just a step. Footbridge across the river downhill.
Now, 79-year-old retiree Richard Manzo walks across the street from his house in Millinocket and into a converted garage that's part workshop, part social club. Shortly after he started at the Millinocket Mill in 1948, he wanted to build a house.
When I got ready to build, they sent a bulldozer over and an engineer. He set up the batter boards, the engineer bulldozed out my foundation, no charge.
The company sent a cement mixer over and paid a guy time and a half to pour the foundation. But those days are a distant memory now. In recent years, ownership of the mills has changed hands many times, and their overall value has declined dramatically.
That's why we lose our jobs, because there's no tax revenue here coming in from the mill, you see what I'm saying? So they have to cut the budgets in the town.
Peter Paletti lost one of his jobs recently, fixing things and doing janitorial work at the East Millinocket Municipal Building. If the mills close, the two towns will lose most of their property tax revenue. Schools may close, teachers and other town workers could get laid off, and programs and services will almost certainly be cut.
People are going to have to move. People are already moving. You know, we've lost a lot of people.
Joan Fisher and some other lifelong Millinocket residents stayed to talk after dinner one night at a restaurant downtown. Fisher worked in one of the mills for years before an injury forced her to quit. She shudders at the possibility they may close for good. If that happens, she says, it's going to be devastating. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field.